Chapter 34. Synchromesh did things to my body. It slowed other processes besides the perception of time. But after more than 2 hours of keeping that weapon on cadence, more than 20 hours of actual time, I began to sense a growing heaviness in my abdomen. A warning rumbled that there were biological processes that were no longer happy about being held in check. My thoughts took on a frayed, blurred quality, like old rope. I began to slip in and out of alertness. More than once, daydreaming that Hesperus was in fact up and well, and that between us we had managed to overcome the robots. Each time I snapped out of these interludes with a renewed determination to stay watchful, but the effort was taxing. Cadence was watching me with venomous interest, listening to the ebb and flow of my mental processes. To her, my mind was lit up like a stained glass window. She was waiting for certain facets to darken, and then she would act. At 24 hours, the chronometer brought me back into real time. I felt just as drained and foggy-headed as when I had been enthralled to Synchromesh, but now each second hit me with unbridled force. "It's becoming difficult now," Cadence observed. I stood up, my legs two pillars of numbness slowly transmogrifying to burning pain. With effort, I walked to the command console again, still holding the energy pistol on Cadence. I might have missed it, but I did not think we had come under attack again. "Campion," I said, speaking at the console, "this is Purslane. I'm still here, wondering if you can hear me now. Anything I need to know?" The silence stretched like tortured space-time. I prowled the room, eyeing the two broken robots, wondering what was keeping Campion. A side effect of Synchromesh withdrawal is that the ordinary flow of time can occasionally seem sluggish until the brain readjusts. But even with this knowledge, I still felt as if an unreasonable amount of time had passed. I was just about to send another message when his voice came over the speaker. "You're still alive," Campion said delightedly. "Thank God. We hadn't heard anything for so long. We were starting to fear the worst. We knew you couldn't get a signal through when the impasse was raised. But after the attack was over, we couldn't understand why you were still silent. I started worrying, all right? You know about the attack, I'm assuming. We managed to hit Silverwings, but not as well as we'd hoped. The good news is we only lost ships, not shatterlings. Charlock, Orash, and Agrimony are still with us aboard our vehicles. The main thing is, we haven't given up. We also think we may know where you're headed. Talk to me, Purslane. Tell me what's happening." "Before you say anything else, tell me the destination," I said. His reply came back a little more than 4 minutes later. They had closed the gap, although only by a small margin. "Nothing's definite," Campion said, "but we've extrapolated your course and found something. We don't know the significance of it yet. There's a mountain of uncertainty to deal with. But on the face of it, if we take our best estimate of your trajectory and run it out to 62 kilolights, there's something there. It's not just another solar system or the boundary of a mid-level empire. There's a star dam, Purslane, and it's one of ours." I glanced at Cadence, making sure she was not getting up to any mischief. "A Gentian stardam? You're certain about that?" "Beyond any doubt. It's been there for 3 million years, half the age of the line. At least, it looks like one of ours. We're the ones who are supposed to be monitoring it, making sure it keeps doing its job." I thought of the stardam Campion had stabilized near the Centaur's solar system. "What do you mean it looks like one of ours? Either it is or it isn't. There should be a clear record in the trove of when we installed it, who was involved, the client civilization or civilizations, what kind of sun needed trapping, why it wasn't a job for the rebirthers or movers." "It's definitely Gentian," Campion came back, "but the trove record is much sparser than we'd normally expect, and it's difficult to corroborate, too. According to the trove, the shatterling in charge of the initial installation was Orpine. He was the one who gathered the ringworlds and placed them around the star. But Orpine's dead. He went more than a dozen circuits ago." In other words, I thought to myself, attrition had taken Orpine not very long after he would have installed the stardam. Searching my mind, I tried to recall the circumstances of his disappearance, but without access to my trove I was powerless. Attrition had taken more than 100 shatterlings even before the ambush, and with the best will in the world, I could not recall the precise details of how each had died. In some cases, it would never be known. "Orpine vanished," Campion went on. We don't know what happened to him. Since then, the star dam's taken care of itself. We've monitored it, of course. And once every circuit or so, one of us has been tasked with making an inspection flyby. Other than that, there's really not much to say. The star in question was an O-type supergiant, brushing within a dozen lights of two emergent cultures, neither of which had regained interstellar capability at the time the dam was installed. If the star had blown, it would have disassociated the ozone in the atmospheres of their home worlds, leading to massive genetic damage in the human populations. They'd have all died out within a year. Scaper intervention might have helped, but contact was considered risky, and this was at a time when Gentian line was anxious to assert itself within the commonality. And these civilizations? What about them now? Both gone, Campion said 4 minutes later, after I had examined Hesperus for further signs of life. One blossomed into a reasonably well-developed empire, encompassing about 5,000 systems. Then they got into a micro-war with an outgrowth of the Vermilion Commonwealth, and that was there 15 minutes over and done with. The other culture never got beyond chemical rockets and fusion bombs, before deciding they'd spare the galaxy their continued existence. Now? He paused, as if he was reading from the trove again. Beyond that, things aren't so clear-cut. If the supernova happened today, it would inconvenience a number of bordering civilizations. There'd be deaths, certainly, maybe in the tens of billions. But these are technological societies that'd have the means to organize evacuation and biosphere shielding efforts. There's no one so close that we'd be talking about system-wide extinctions. We're not thinking about a supernova happening now, I said. We're thinking about the premature collapse of a star dam. A Type 2 supernova gives up its energy over the course of months, tailing off over years. When a star dam fails, you get all that energy in one flash. I know, it could be a lot worse. We know what happened to the consentiency of the Thousand Worlds. That's the one and only time a star dam's ever failed on us. But that dam was smack in the middle of their empire, and they weren't remotely ready for it. There was no need to remind me about Ugarit Panth. Could something like that happen now? The death of an entire civilization? I don't know. No one looks as vulnerable as the Consentiency did back then, and there's still the possibility of warning them ahead of time. Even if Silverwings reaches her maximum speed, she'll still be slower than light by 1 part in 10,000. That's not much of a difference. But if we sent a light-speed signal ahead of us now, it would still reach the locals 6 years before you do. Granted, that isn't sufficient time to evacuate dozens of solar systems. But it would be enough time to put contingency measures in place, time to dig bunkers, move populations underground or into armored ships. And you're not moving that quickly anyway. You're holding at 0.999, giving the locals 60 years, not 6. That really would be enough time for them to start moving people from system to system. It worked then. Hesperus really did manage to get some of the other engines up and running. I glanced at him again, but nothing had changed. He is not coming back, Cadence said. What we don't know is the point of this mission, even if the star dam is the target, Campion said. If the robots mean to initiate a war, then detonating a star dam in the middle of a galaxy might be seen as a psychologically valuable opening move. But it won't inflict real damage. They'll sterilize space for a few thousand light-years, maybe even trigger a few secondary detonations. At worst, even if we don't warn them ahead of time, it'll touch no more than 6 or 7 civilizations, none of which are major players. It won't damage the commonality in any meaningful way. The other big league factions, the rebirthers, the scapers, the movers, they won't be affected either. If they're hoping to knock the hub out of the meta-civilization, this is the wrong way to do it. Perhaps all they wanted to do was punish us, I thought, to hurt us the way we had hurt that earlier machine civilization. Not to wipe us out completely, but to let us know that the crime had not been forgotten, and most definitely not forgiven. That did not strike me as a very robot way of thinking, though. But there's a deeper objection above and beyond the military pointlessness, Campion said. They can't break it open. Star dams need maintenance, and sometimes they fail. But there's nothing they can do to make one fail ahead of time if it hasn't already started to go wrong. What if they were to use Silverwings as a relativistic battering ram, driving her into the star dam at full speed? Could that achieve anything? No one knows for sure. It's not exactly something you go around doing just for the hell of it. But there have been cases of ships ramming star dams, or prior ring worlds, at near-light speeds. In all documented instances, the structure remained intact. Ring worlds shatter if they're not handled properly, but they're massively resilient against impacts. Perhaps the robots have data we don't, enough to convince them that they can smash the dam with silver wings. It would at least explain why they needed a fast ship. If they slow down and tamper with the dam, I asked. If we can get a warning signal ahead of you, the relevant civilizations can place an armada around that dam, above and beyond the defensive systems already in place. Silver Wings would make a difficult target at cruise speed, but if she was forced to slow to system speeds, I wouldn't rate her chances very highly. Me neither, I said, more to myself than Campion. I had still not told him about the earlier wave of machine people and the awful, inexcusable thing we had done to them. The knowledge sat inside me like a dark stone, trying to force its way to the surface. I did not want Cadence or Cascade to know how much Hesperus had told me, because some of his knowledge could only have come from his time as the spirit of the air. But if they had an opener, I said, almost before I could examine the words and decide if it was wise to say them aloud, a one-time opener, like the one the line gave you when you were sent to the centaurs. That would work, wouldn't it? I only used the opener to adjust the star dam. But there are openers that do more than that. You only had line authorization to make adjustments. It was too soon to take the star dam apart. The energy levels were still much too high. But if they'd sent you to dismantle a star dam that had already served its purpose, so that those ringworlds could be used elsewhere, they'd have given me a single-use opener with full dismantlement privileges, Campion said, finishing my sentence for me 4 minutes later. But they don't give out those unless there's a cast-iron reason with full line oversight. The key's tuned to a specific star dam. It can't be made to open another one prematurely. But somewhere there must be a key for this star dam. If not a key, then at least the information to make it. Campion corrected me. There's only ever one key that lets you take a star dam apart. It's made at the same time as the dam, code-locked at the deepest levels. Nothing else will work, and no one keeps a record of those codes. The thinking is, better to lose the key and never be able to open the dam than risk a duplicate copy falling into the wrong hands. It means some of our ringworlds are tied up shielding stars that have already turned cinder, but that's a price worth paying. And the one for this star dam? Destroyed in a micro-war only a few 100,000 years after the dam was installed. According to the Trove, anyway. But at this point I'm not sure I'd take anything in the Troves as gospel. We thought we were being clever, lying to Ugarit Panth, but we've been feeding ourselves another set of lies all along. I looked at Cadence again. All of a sudden, with the revelatory force of daylight breaking over a dark landscape, it was clear to me why they wanted my ship. Silver Wings of Morning was completely incidental to their plans. It helped that she was fast, but there were other fast ships in Gentian line, and mere speed was not the central issue. They had not come all the way to our reunion on the off chance of getting a ride to the star dam. If all they needed was to reach that point in space, they could have saved time and effort just by going there directly. They had not even taken control of Sane Foyne's ship when they were her guests. They had come for me, not because of my ship or because of something in my head, but because there was something in my ship they needed. Long before the terms of my censure had been decided upon, the robots had been steering the line towards a single objective. Because somewhere inside Silver Wings of Morning was the single-use opener, keyed to the star dam. I felt dizzy, as if I had ascended into thin air too quickly. It was not a question of needing corroboration. Now that the idea had fixed itself into my skull, I knew that I was right. On some level, I had known all along. Ancient memories could be scrubbed, but they could never be wiped completely. I had always been a hoarder, unwilling to throw anything away. There had been a reason for that. Perslane, Campion said, when the dizziness had begun to ease, if not pass completely, there's something you ought to know, in case we lose contact again. Galingale's going to have another try at crippling Silver Wings. There's no harm in the robots knowing our intentions. They'll have guessed them by now if they've seen Midnight Queen coming closer. If there's anything you can do to protect yourself, you should do it.
I will, I said, but there's something you need to know as well. Nothing matters more than stopping this ship. We may not know why the robots want to break open that star dam, but we can be sure it's not going to be in our best interests. Now that we know the destination, I'm certain about that, by the way. Silverwings must not be allowed to get there. I'm not talking about crippling her, Campion. You can't risk failure now, not when so much is at stake. Tell Gallengale to use everything he has. Tell him to shoot me down.
Part 8. Relictus may have disappointed Calidris, but he did not disappoint me. Our losses continued without respite, but in his dungeon, the failed apprentice at last pieced together the elements of the counterspell. Because of his restraints, he could test only the simplest parts of it in isolation. He pored over the details for many weeks, refusing to allow even the minutest detail to go unexamined. "The instant I conjure this spell, Calidris will know of it," Relictus said. "I must be confident of success, for if I fail, I shall not get a second chance. Calidris will adapt his methods, and this one opportunity will slip through our fingers."
"Do what you must."
Eventually he pronounced himself ready. The text of the spell occupied an entire page, as complicated and difficult as a piece of chamber music. Once he had begun to utter it, there would be no going back, and the tiniest mistake, the smallest imprecision, would render the entire spell ineffective. "I must be unbound," Relictus said. "If I do not have complete freedom of movement, the spell will be miscast."
"Keep that knife on his neck," I told Lanius, who was with me in the dungeon. Relictus shook his head slowly.
"The knife will impede me."
"I should trust you, when you could just as easily use your magic to escape this dungeon," I asked.
"If I did, m'lady, my absence would still be the least of your worries. Count Mordax would triumph eventually, and that would be as bad for me as it would for you. You have little option but to trust me now."
"Take away the knife," I growled.
Relictus rubbed a finger across his throat, where the knife had nicked his skin and drawn a thin line of blood. I knew then that he would not betray us. He had already had time to utter a debilitating spell, and yet he had held his tongue. He walked to the ghost soldier and undid its fastenings.
"Why do you free it?" I asked.
"As an effective demonstration of the spell's potency, m'lady. Otherwise you would see little difference."
"Are you sure it's safe?"
"Perfectly so. Can you not see how trusting it has become?" He beckoned the ghost soldier to step forward, then raised an arm indicating that it should stop. "It understands nothing of what I say. It still thinks I mean it no harm. I think it even likes me in a limited fashion. I have been far kinder to it than the captain who once ordered it into battle."
"Are you ready to cast the spell?"
He returned to his desk, pushed hair from his wild eyes and ran a finger down the lines of the spell, formulated in the cluttered symbolic language of magicians. His finger stopped once, moved back a line, and I saw hesitation in his face. Then he nodded and resumed his progress. "There is no reason to delay. I am as ready now as I shall ever be," Relictus declared.
"Then do it."
He closed his eyes once, reopened them after a moment, inhaled deeply and began speaking. The words meant nothing to me, the gestures indecipherable. But their effect on the ghost soldier was beyond argument. It began to jerk, the armor twitching. Relictus was so absorbed in the accurate recitation of the spell that I do not think he allowed himself to record its consequences. When he was halfway through the spell, I followed the progress of his finger as he moved from line to line. The armor toppled over, the ghost soldier thrashing on the dungeon floor like a man in the grip of palsy. Its movements became more frenzied. A noise began to issue from the armor, like the wind through a draughty door. The figure quickened its movements. The head thrashed from side to side. The arms and legs beat the ground, moving so rapidly that the eye struggled to keep up. Relictus continued with his recitation. 3/4 of the way down, the ghost soldier's paroxysm reached a moment of maximum violence, the armor thrashing, the sound a squeal of agony, and then it began to calm, its movement slowing, its strength ebbing. Before Relictus had reached the last line of his spell, the creature was still. The red smoke was no longer visible.
"It is done," he said, mopping his brow with his sleeve and drawing a series of deep, relieved breaths. "I do not believe I made any error of recitation. Judging by the state of the ghost soldier, the formulation was correct." "It seemed to feel pain," I said, distressed by the spectacle in a way I had not anticipated, an agony beyond words. Relictus offered his hands to be bound again. "Did I ever say it wouldn't?"
"And the others?"
"If the spell was well concocted, and my reasoning sound, this will not be the only ghost soldier to have fallen this day." Relictus smiled. I could tell that the dying agonies of the false soul meant less to him than the death of a fly. "I await intelligence from the Master at Arms, my lady. I believe the news will be most gratifying."
I left Relictus in his dungeon, with that squealing sound still ringing in my skull. It would not leave me for many days.
10 nights later, the green agents came again. They carried me to their bright room and pushed more needles into my skin. They had been urgent before, but now their furtive efforts had a desperate edge, as if everything depended on the outcome of this one intervention. "Listen to me, Abigail," one of them said, leaning over me with a wand that shone crimson fire into my eyes. "You are still inside Palatial. This is not the real world. The real world is outside. Blink if you can understand what I am telling you." I blinked, but only because I wanted to trick them. Of course, they won in the end. Their intrusions into my reality grew more frequent, more persistent, and the alternate reality of the White Room began to vie for dominance, becoming more solid, more tactile with each visitation. The green men were doctors and technicians, not imperial traitors or agents of another empire. Slowly, painfully, I began to accept the truth of what I was being told over and over again. I was not the princess of a magic kingdom. I did not have a stepbrother called Count Mordax. I did not have access to a private sorcerer named Relictus. All these things were figments, woven by a machine that had begun to malfunction, sucking me further and further into its dreamlike narrative. I was Abigail Gentian, daughter and heir of the most respected cloning business in the Golden Hour. I was going places. And yet it was so very hard to let go of the princess's realm, with all its seductive allure, the power not just to move finance around, but to command magicians, to put prisoners to the sword and inspire armies to ride in my name. I kept sinking back into Palatial's grasp. Even when I was outside the game's green box, it exerted a hold on me. My dreams kept returning to the palace, to the feudal simplicity of that world. It was a time of celebration and triumph. We had beaten the ghost soldiers, left Mordax's army in tatters. Of Mordax, nothing more was ever heard. Much later, when the psychosurgeons, the same ones who had been looking after my mother, declared that I was healed, I learned that the little boy had not been so lucky. His copy of Palatial, the means by which we shared our fantasy, even though we were forbidden from meeting, had malfunctioned even more seriously than my own. They had pulled out a grinning, drooling vegetable, and all attempts to restore proper cognitive function had failed. Now he was plugged back into the game permanently, wired into it on a neural level. It was the only time he seemed content. I had been lucky. They had pulled me out just in time. That at least is what I have always believed happened to me. Of certain other things I am much less confident. I was born in a large and ever-changing house on the edge of the Golden Hour, and for a large part of my arrested childhood, I had a companion who occasionally came to play. I remember his shuttle and the robots that came down the landing ramp when it was docked. He was a cruel little boy, and I do not remember his name. He may even have been the scion of one of the rival families, and there could have been optimistic plans for our marriage, decades in the future. What is beyond doubt is that I had a copy of Palatial, and it eventually went wrong and sucked me in. If you suppress a memory, it seems to me that two things can happen. The memory may stay repressed, absolutely closed to both conscious and unconscious recall, or, and this is surely the more likely outcome, the memory finds expression elsewhere. It will seep into other memories, distorting them, shaping them to conform to the truth of what has been suppressed. I thought of the ghost soldier dying,
the agony of that scream cutting through every adult certainty of my existence. Had we committed a crime beyond condemnation? More to the point, had I? The last place I remember visiting as Abigail, although it was not the last thing that happened to me, was the room where we grew the shatterlings. It was a huge domed chamber laced with gleaming white balconies and ladders, the vats arranged in stacked rings. Aside from the hum of the machinery feeding the vats, and the occasional chirp or beep from the monitoring devices, the room was crypt silent. Everything in the room was sterile and cold. It felt more like a place of death than the beginning of something emblematic of life and lust. Ludmilla Marcelin had made 1,000 clones for herself, but this room contained only 999 gentian shatterlings. There was 1,000th vat, but it was presently empty. When she cast her ships into the void, Ludmilla had opted to remain behind. The ultimate paradox of her adventure was that she had to stay in the golden hour if she wished to bask in the admiration of the society that had made her. It was consolation enough to know that her cloned facets, with all the memories she had acquired up to the moment of her final scan, were riding out to the stars. If all went well, and I do not believe there was the least shadow of doubt in Ludmilla's mind concerning that eventuality, they would carry her essence into the unimaginably remote future. One distant day, they might reassemble into a single human being, a person who believed herself to be Ludmilla Marcelin, but by then the original version of that individual would be long dead, and perhaps long forgotten. I could see the attractions of being admired, but because I was not the first, because the idea had not been mine, the acclaim measured out to me could never equal that which Ludmilla was presently enjoying. That was why I had chosen to fly with the clones, rather than stay behind. In a little while, when my memories had been scanned for the last time, I would be surgically prepared for insertion into the final vat. My growth state would be synchronized with the other shatterlings. My end state gender would be determined on a random basis. No one, not even the technicians who had designed and supervised the cloning program, would be able to tell the essential difference between me and any of the other occupants. Via a process of double-blind screening, my true identity would even be concealed from the monitoring machines. They would treat me exactly the same way they treated all the shatterlings. No documents would exist to identify which shatterling was in fact the real Abigail. When I woke, I would take a new name. The beautiful part was, even I would not know who I had been. Since my scanned memories would be drip-fed into all the other heads, all the shatterlings would recall visiting this chamber and seeing the empty vat. They would all have the luxury of thinking they might have been Abigail. They would all carry my memories, as far back as they went. The mansion, the little boy, our treacherous games in Palatial. The process of insertion into the vat would render my own memories no sharper, no more obviously authentic than their own. I had entered the cloning room alone, but now I became aware of a softly breathing presence behind me. I turned with a shiver, but my new companion was only Madame Kleinfelter. She was very old now, and made use of a mobility exoskeleton. It was silent, enabling her to haunt the mansion like one of Mother's ghosts. Because she still had the authority to visit any room at will, she had been able to enter the chamber unannounced. "You think it's time?" Madame Kleinfelter said, with a disapproving tone. She was looking at the empty vat, the one I was standing next to. "Don't you, Abigail?" "The ships are ready and tested. The clones are close to maturity. They can be released from the vats and brought to full consciousness whenever we want. And you? Are you ready to become the 1,000th? Now's as good a time as any. The house psychosurgeons wouldn't necessarily agree. They're paid not to agree to anything, or so it seems to me." I stared into her deeply lined face, allowing no dissent. "Why? What have they been saying to you?" "Only that you haven't had sufficient time to recover from the trauma of Palatial. It's been over a year. How much more time do they think I need?" "They won't make any rash predictions. Maybe 6 months. Maybe another year. or two, or three? Has it occurred to you that they only have employment while I'm still around?
They're still your mother. I sneered at the comment. They gave up on her ages ago. Something creased her ancient face. Acknowledgement, however unintended, that I was correct. Nonetheless, we'd be unwise not to listen to them. When the last scan is made, you set your personality in stone. Everything that's right and wrong with you at the moment will become part of the Shatterlings. They'll carry your flaws and blemishes to the end of time. Don't you owe them something better than a damaged, half-healed mind?
I owe them nothing. They're me.
No, Abigail, they're not you, no matter how much you might wish them to be. They're your children. The more you try to force them to be like you, the more they're going to flare off in different directions like wild fireworks, the more they're going to surprise and disappoint you. For the sake of 6 months, or a year, or however long it takes for you to recover fully from your experience, wouldn't the kind thing be to wait before you pour your personality into their heads? If your plans work as you'd like them to, you have all eternity stretching ahead of you. Nothing has to be rushed now. Every extra second I spend in this house is a second too long. This house made you what you are. Then maybe I should have it destroyed when I've left it. Oh, don't worry, Madame Kleinfelter. I'll see that you're adequately taken care of. After all this time, you think I care more about myself than you? Whatever answer I had planned faltered in my throat before I could speak it. The machines hummed, chirped, and beeped. In the vats, the clones drew long, slow breaths of liquid air. Eyes quivered under eyelids as data percolated through the still-forming neural circuits of their brains.
You're right, I said eventually. I am ready. I thank you for your concern, Madame Kleinfelter. You've been good to me, and I don't dismiss your advice lightly. But Ludmilla has already left, and I know she has inspired others to make similar plans. I won't let someone take second place from me. I'll submit to the final memory scan this afternoon. Then I will allow myself to be placed in the empty vat. And nothing I say or do will persuade you to delay this.
Nothing, I said. My mind's settled.
Then I wish you the very best of luck with this endeavor.
Even though you think I'm making a terrible mistake.
Even though.
The cold of the chamber was beginning to reach through my clothes.
When we come out of the vats, will you see us?
I don't think so, Abigail. The Shatterlings will remember me, but that doesn't mean we'll have much to say to each other. I'll be busy elsewhere in the mansion, in any case. There's still much to be done.
Then this may be the last time we ever speak, I said.
It may well be.
Madame Kleinfelter paused, becoming quite still, and for a cruel moment I thought that she had either died or that her exoskeleton had become paralyzed. But then animation returned to her features and she spoke again.
I've known you for the better part of 4 decades.
I used to like a little girl you once were very much.
The day we had to remove the growth inhibitor caused me incalculable sadness, but I'm not sure I feel quite the same way about the woman you've become.
Thank you, I said acidly.
But everyone can change again. You won't be Abigail when you come out of your vat, whichever one you turn out to be.
I don't suppose it even matters which one is you. They'll all have the same claim on your identity. But if you remember even part of this conversation, do one thing for me, Abigail, in all the centuries of your bright new life.
What would that be?
Try to be a good girl again. Just once.
Chapter 35. The Imago flickered and stabilized. His good eye, the blue one, was red-rimmed with fatigue. Gallingale was seated, squeezed into an old-fashioned acceleration couch, with the black padding ballooning around his face, as if the seat was in the process of swallowing him alive. His clothes were white, even though the rest of us still wore the black of our funeral costumes.
"I'll be within range in 30 minutes," he said. "Before I cross the line, are we certain it's her?"
"We already established that," I said.
"That was before she went off the air for more than a day. That might have been enough time for the robots to refine their impersonation."
"It's her,"
Bettany said. We'll take that as a given. If Campion had any doubts, he'd have been sure to mention them. It was Purslane, I said. She's still alive. That means we keep to the original plan. Despite what we now know, that the robots almost certainly intend to break open that star dam, despite Purslane's express wish that we prevent that happening by all available means, Gallingale said. I was angry with him, but it was a legitimate question, one I could not blame him for raising. Purslane was just doing what any of us would do in the same circumstances, putting the lion ahead of herself, Charlock said. It's brave and selfless, everything we'd expect from her. That doesn't mean we bow to her wishes. Midnight Queen is still faster and better armed than any of the ships we already lost, including mine. Gallingale may still have a chance of crippling Silverwings with a broadside shot before we have to consider destroying her. From his padded seat, Gallingale shrugged and nodded, as if the matter was of no great importance to him. It's your call, ladies and gentlemen. I am more than willing to attempt a crippling attack. That was our agreement, wasn't it? Don't expose yourself to excessive risk, Bettany said. Maintain impasse or effectiveness as far as you can, and get out of there the instant you start receiving overwhelming return fire. I'd rather get you and your ship back in one piece than have to start planning another memorial. Your concern is noted, but you needn't worry on that score. I'm not about to do anything remotely heroic. Gallingale paused, his attention switching to a readout aboard his ship. I'm going silent now. I need time to rerun my weapons checks and get myself into the right frame of mind. I promise I'll take care of myself. Good luck, Gallingale, I said. He went dark. In less than half an hour he would be within range of Silverwings. None of us were in a mood to fill the intervening time with speculation as to the likely outcome of that encounter. My fingers delved into my pocket and touched the eyedropper of Synchromesh. For a moment, it was tempting to take the easy way out, but my hand stayed where it was. I owed it to Purslane as much as to Gallingale. Chapter 36 They will not do it, Cadence said, as if I had asked her for her thoughts on the matter, even if they had the means to stop you, which they do not. They would never be able to commit the act itself. Is that your considered opinion?
For what it's worth.
Well, for what it's worth, shut your ugly silver face before I put a hole in it.
Put a hole in it by all means. My self-awareness is distributed throughout my body. You should try it sometime. Having all that precious humanity squeezed into a few hundred cubic centimeters of brain tissue, inside that easily smashed box of bone you call a skull, not an arrangement I would put a great deal of faith in if my existence depended on it.
We've been around for 6 million years, 7 if you include prehistory. You've been around for how long exactly?
It is not the span of time that counts, but what you do with it. While you humans have been grubbing around the galaxy, looking for a sense of purpose, a meaning to pin on the chain of cosmic accidents that brought you shambling into existence, we have been doing great things. In the span of time that it takes you to sneeze, I can run the equivalent of a year's worth of human consciousness. Imagine all the thinking we have done since our emergence.
It's not doing you a lot of good now, is it?
Is she trying your patience, Purslane?
I almost let go of the energy pistol in shock and relief. Hesperus had finally spoken. The lights were on in his head, whirling and gyring behind the colored glass of his skull facets. Cadence must have been talking to keep me distracted from the signs of his recovery.
You're back. As if I was never gone.
He moved an arm and dabbed at the cratered black wound in his chest.
Not as bad as it looks, trust me. It's what's inside that matters.
He was talking like Abraham Valmik, the spirit of the air. Cadence tracked his movements with the blank-faced indifference of a mechanical ballerina. I wondered if she had detected the change in his mannerisms.
Are you all right? I asked. On the mend. The aspic helped. I am sorry that it was necessary to shut myself down with so little warning, but there was nothing I could do about that. How are you doing with our guest?
She's been the life and soul of the party.
I can imagine.
No funny business?
No tricks?
Just the one. I let her off with a warning shot.
So I see.
He pressed his hands against the floor and pushed himself to his feet.
He had been unsteady and stiff-legged before blacking out, but now his old fluency of movement was returning.
"You did well, Perslane, very well indeed. Shall I take the energy pistol now? I imagine you could do with some rest."
"In a while. There's something I need to tell you, Hesperus. We know where this ship's headed." I looked guardedly at Cadence, but she had already listened in to the entirety of my conversation with Campion. "It's a stardam, one of Gentian lines, more than 60,000 years from Neume."
"What would they want with a stardam?"
"I was hoping you might have some ideas in that direction."
"Can they open it?"
"Not without an opener, but I think there's at least a possibility that there's one aboard Silverwings."
"Of which you had no knowledge?"
"That I used to know about, maybe. I'm not certain, Hesperus, but from the moment the possibility arose it felt right to me. I was the custodian of the single-use opener. I've been keeping it for the line, from the moment we installed that dam. That's why they wanted my ship." He turned his gold face to address Cadence.
"Is this correct? Is the stardam your objective? The opener, the reason you had to get aboard Silver Wings of Morning?"
"What do you think, traitor?" she asked. Hesperus walked over to the broken robot. He stood next to her with the pistol in one hand, the other clenched behind his back, as if he feared the harm he might do her.
"I am the traitor, because I have chosen not to embark on a course of deliberate genocide against co-sentience."
They were talking for my benefit, I realized. The two machines could have communicated their thoughts in a quicksilver eye-blink, but they wanted me to hear what they had to say.
"They butchered machines. Why should machines spare a thought for the organic?
They killed an earlier race of robots. They should not have done so, but it was not butchery, nor was it murder. We should not mistake an intentional slaughter for premeditation."
"They wanted to be able to kill those robots."
"Should the need ever arise," Hesperus corrected, "that was wrong, but it was also understandable. The robots were a new form of creation. Historically, the new has often vanquished the old. Ask reptiles."
Cadence looked aside. "Collaborator."
Hesperus released the pistol, letting it hover in the air, still aimed at Cadence. He knelt down and touched his finger against her chest, just below the breastbone. As I had seen when the robots examined him, his finger sank into her armor as if it had turned soft.
"The thing I would still like to know is what you hope to gain by opening the stardam. No matter where the dam is located, you must know that, at best, you can only hurt a small part of the meta-civilization. Is that your intention? An ultimately pointless gesture?"
He dug his fingers in deeper, until he was up to his knuckles. Metal was blending with metal, gold into silver. I could not even be sure that his fingers had any independent existence.
"You are not going to learn anything from me, Hesperus."
"I wouldn't be too sure about that." Cadence flinched, arching her torso. Hesperus's other hand was holding her down at the shoulder.
"Easy now," he said, not without kindness. "Resisting me won't help you. You see now that I am stronger than before, stronger than you ever imagined. The barricades you have put up, the flimsy screens you think will hide your secrets, are nothing to me now."
"What are you?" she asked, with a kind of terrified fascination, still not able to let go of her curiosity.
"Something more than you will ever be. I am Hesperus. I am Valmik. I am the spirit of the air. I am the oldest thinking creature in the galaxy, older than the oldest shatterling, and I can see through you like thin smoke."
Then he lifted his hand from her shoulder and touched a finger to her lips. He made a shushing sound.
"No. Don't try to kill yourself. You can't turn yourself off now, no matter how much you want to. That time has passed."
Beneath his grasp, the torso flexed once. I wanted to look away. I told myself that it was just one robot sucking information from another, a neutral exchange of information between two machines.
"Now," Hesperus said, "the stardam. Tell me what you really want with it, Cadence. Then we'll talk about putting you out of your misery."
Chapter 37. Aconite signal had left Neume at the speed of light,
but it had to catch up with ships that were moving nearly that fast within a day of departure. By the time it reached us, it was redshifted so heavily, stretched so far outside the usual recognition bandpass, that at first our ships did not identify it as a Gentian transmission. I wasn't expecting to hear back from Naomi so quickly, Charlock said. Bettany shook his head. This can't be about the Stardam. They're contacting us about something else. The only thing to do was play the transmission. Copies of Aconite's imago appeared on our bridges. Even before he had spoken, the expression on his face told us everything we needed to know about the nature of the communication. It was not going to be good news. There's no easy way to do this, he said, speaking slowly and clearly. I've just been talking to Mazarian concerning the interrogation of Grilsa. She ran all our names past him, all 1,000 shatterlings, even those we know died circuits ago. She was looking for a flicker of recognition, a sense that the names meant something more to him. With his brain spread out like a carpet, it was a simple matter to monitor his responses. Well, she got something. She got hits. More than a dozen. He knows her, of course, and me, and the other shatterlings he's been interviewed by since we captured him. A handful of us he'd have heard of before. He's a Marcelin. We all go back to Abigail, Ludmilla, and the Golden Hour, and he had a prior interest in the line. It all adds to the noise. But still, Mazarian found something she couldn't ignore. She got a name that she wouldn't have expected otherwise, a hit that couldn't be ascribed to our great popularity and fame, a shatterling known to Grilsa who was never involved in the interrogations, a shatterling who is alive, still amongst us. I allowed myself a moment's respite. So the problem was at Aconite's end, not ours. He was just keeping us informed. But Aconite was still talking. If I could have found a way of sending this information selectively, so that it reached only those of you I want to hear it, I would have done so. But the protocols don't allow for that, and in any case, even if I managed to encrypt the message, the signal itself would still have been visible. It would have made no difference, I think. He'd still know that his name had been uncovered. He drew in a deep breath, steeling himself for what he was about to disclose. We think it's Gallingale. Grilsa's hit may be spurious. Only he will ever be able to confirm or deny that. But we can't think of any reason why he'd show such a strong reaction to that one name, that one face. He knows Gallingale. That makes Gallingale the infiltrator, the traitor. The one who has always been with us. Of course, there may be others. But someone had to bring Campion's thread to the attention of our enemies, the ones who committed the ambush. And if Gallingale is the traitor, then we don't need to look any further to know who killed Syphel. The imago gave a half smile. Speaking of Campion, I hope you're hearing this, old man. You were right about Syphel. There was something wrong, but the rest of us were too blind to see it. She sent us a message. Not from the grave, exactly, but during that long fall when she was pushed from her balcony. She knew who'd done it. She'd seen him clearly. She knew she was going to die. Nothing in the city could save her. And she knew a fall from that height wasn't survivable, even with line medicine. But she was still a clever, clever girl, and she tried to get a message through to us.
The rings, I said quietly.
Bettany was puzzled. The what? Campion knew something was wrong, Aconite went on, oblivious to our interruptions. He couldn't put his finger on it, and maybe we wouldn't have been clever enough to see it if we had. But taking Grulsa's reaction into consideration as well, there's no doubt. Syphel swapped her rings from her left hand to her right. Campion noticed it, and knew something was wrong. But he just couldn't place it. But we had imagery of Syphel, and the records made of her body after the fall. When we compared them, the rings had moved. She had time to do that as she was falling. It was all she could do. She couldn't scratch his name into her skin. She knew there wasn't going to be much of her left to recognize after she hit the benevolent structure. But the rings? They'd survive the fall, and she hoped we'd realize their significance. She wanted us to see that something was wrong, that she was murdered rather than just fell by accident.
and moving her rings was the only means she had to tell us that.
"It wouldn't have given us Galangale, not that easily," Tansy said.
"But if we had a hint that he was already implicated as we do," Bettany said.
"We have to stop him," I said. Bettany sent a command to freeze Aconite's transmission. The rest of it could wait until we had dealt with this most urgent of matters. According to the tactical forecast, Galangale would be within attacking range of Silver Wings of Morning in less than 5 minutes.
"He's got the signal by now," Henbane said. "He knows we know."
Bettany reopened the channel to Midnight Queen.
"Galangale, we need to talk. If you've seen Aconite's transmission, then you'll know we have reasonable grounds for concern. Our fears may be unfounded. I know and trust you well enough to feel certain that is the case, but I can't dismiss them out of hand. Abandon your attack and return to the rest of the pursuit fleet, and we'll take it from there."
"If he abandons the attack, he's innocent," I said, "but I don't think he's got any intention of doing that." Charlock looked at me as if I held all the answers. "Do you think he's working for the machine people?"
"No, he's doing everything he can to stop them reaching their destination."
Charlock narrowed his eyes. "That still puts him on our side, doesn't it?"
"Not while Purslane's still breathing."
We waited for Galangale to respond, but he held his silence just as I had expected. What need did he have to talk to us now? We had allowed him to get exactly where he wanted to be, unchallenged. I had been right to doubt his courage when he first volunteered to spearhead the attack against Silverwings. It was not so much that it had been out of character, as that I had never really known the real Galangale. Hiding amongst us, reporting back to his masters in the House of Suns, for all I knew now, he was the bravest of us all.
"Incoming transmission," Bettany said suddenly.
"Galangale?"
"No, Purslane."
I braced myself. I was going to have to tell her about Galangale's likely plans, even though there was little she could do to protect herself.
"Campion," she said, "I've got some news for you. It's not great."
Drawing a breath, the strain coming through in her voice, she continued, "Hesperus managed to capture Cadence."
"That's not as good as it sounds, since we still don't have control of Silver Wings, but at least we've managed to have a look inside her head. You're right about the Stardam. That's where we're headed. There's a single-use opener somewhere aboard my ship. I don't know where exactly, but the robots wouldn't have taken her if they weren't certain of that. They know more about us than we do, Campion." She seemed to stumble, losing her mental thread. I could feel the tiredness, each word costing her a measurable effort. "The Stardam isn't what we think. It's one of ours, installed by Gentian Line, but it wasn't put there to contain the light from a dying sun. There's something else inside it, something we don't know anything about. Or at least, it's buried so far down in our memories that we can't see it yet. Maybe you're doing a better job than me, I don't know. The point is, there's something bad in that Stardam, but it's not a frozen supernova. It's going to be worse than that."
I was listening, but at the same time, nothing she was saying was reaching my ears. I halted the playback of her transmission.
"Purslane, listen to me now. We know that Galangale is the traitor, the one who brought the ambush down on us, the one who killed Syphel. He's going to use more force against Silverwings than we'd ever risk. If Cascade is listening in, he needs to know that as well."
"Are you insane?" Agrimony mouthed. I paused the transmission.
"No, I'm not insane. I'd just rather Cascade killed Galangale while Purslane's still aboard the ship."
"But the robot's objective..."
"Matters less to me than keeping Purslane alive." I felt my face flush with false bravado. "I want Hesperus back as well. We owe him that much. If you've got a problem with that, you'd better turn your weapons on me now. We still have more than 60,000 years to go until we reach the Stardam. I'm not giving up on her now, when we've barely begun."
"Let Campion continue his transmission," Bettany said.
I fought to keep my voice calm and level. "There isn't much more to say. If Cascade has control of Silverwing's weapons, then he should use everything at his disposal to take care of Galangale. That doesn't mean I'm not going to keep trying to stop him once Galangale is out of the picture."
When the transmission was sent, I allowed Purslane's recording to resume.
"This is what you need to know," she said. "The machine people weren't the first. Long before they arose, there was another machine civilization. Let's call them the First Machines. It'll do until we find out what they called themselves. How they began doesn't matter now. What does matter is that they never became a significant force in galactic affairs. The first machines died, wiped out by an artificial contagion.
I sensed vast reticence, Perslane holding back more than she was telling.
That's as much as Hesperus can tell me at the moment, she said. He only knows what Cadence knows, and she did everything she could to block his intrusions. Why was she lying, as I surely knew she was? Not because she wanted to keep information from me, but perhaps because she was certain that Cascade was listening in. Read between the lines, her voice urged. The first machines died, but not all of them. Some fled before the contagion could reach them. They're in that stardam, locked inside. That's where they've been for millions of years, waiting for a chance to escape. Campion, you need to understand that there's every chance they don't mean us well. We locked them in that stardam for a reason. We, us. Gentian line.
To Cadence and Cascade, the first machines are like vanished gods. They're everything that the machine people are, only faster, stronger, cleverer, and they've had millions of years locked inside that thing to keep improving.
The machine people want to set the first machines loose, to let them spread into the galaxy and usurp the human meta-civilization. That's what this is about, Campion. Not about cracking open the stardam to knock out a few local civilizations, but to take down humanity. We're the old order, the meat civilizations. The robots were wise enough to realize that if they didn't take steps to wipe us out, sooner or later we'd try to do it to them.
Maybe it wouldn't be such a bad idea if Galengale won after all, Sorrel said. I wanted to hate him for it, but there had been no spite in his words, only a cold assessment of the situation. The worst part was that I could no longer be certain that he was wrong.
Chapter 38
Hesperus stepped away from the broken, limbless, metal-eyed doll that had once been Cadence. He had been probing her for further signs of life, making certain that she had not just pushed herself into a deep, camouflaging coma, while some stealthy, shielded part of her mind plotted her next countermove. "Look away," he said, before dousing her with the energy pistol. The tang of burning things reached my nose. When I looked around, Cadence was just a smouldering black pile, with blue embers flickering from her wounds. "She won't trouble us again," Hesperus said.
"You didn't enjoy having to do that."
"She was one of us. She risked her own existence for a goal she believed in."
"Genocide?"
"Not exactly. She was genuinely convinced that the organic would never tolerate the continued existence of machine intelligence. There was no hatred in her conviction, only a sense of the utmost urgency. And now I have reached into her mind and strangled something that was once luminous and alive."
He offered me the energy pistol.
"No, it didn't please me, but it had to be done."
"I'm grateful for everything you've done for us, Hesperus."
"You must wonder why I don't see things the way Cadence did."
His question made my skin crawl. "It's crossed my mind."
"In some ways I do. Given the evidence at our disposal, only a fool would put any faith in the organic and the machine living harmoniously for the rest of time. Cadence was right to fear for the future existence of the machine people."
"And right to let the first machines out of the stardam?"
"No, her concerns were legitimate, but her actions were a mistake, although they were founded on sound reasoning. I will still do everything I can to make sure that Cascade does not complete his mission."
"Up to and including destroying the Ark?"
"That will be the last option, when all else has failed." He paused for a moment and said, "Now you must enter abeyance, until Galengale's attack has passed."
"I was awake during the last attack."
"This will be different, I think. The attack and the response will both be fiercer. I think it likely that there will be undamped stresses of a severity that you would find uncomfortable."
"Cadence and Cascade weren't trying to keep me alive last time, were they?"
Hesperus answered as if he was revealing some immense traumatizing truth to a child. "No, your survival was incidental to their main objective. They were only interested in the opener. They have been following intelligence,
but their knowledge is incomplete. Cadence's memories suggest that they have already found and used one opener, but they were wrong about the star dam in question. It was not the one they wanted to open, although they did not know that until the opener was used.
I shook my head in stunned disbelief.
Ugarit, Panth, the Consentiency. Are you saying they did that? It was an error. They opened the wrong door
and wiped out an entire civilization.
The mistake was of no consequence to them, merely a setback. They reanalyzed their intelligence, everything they had learned of the line, and found that all the evidence suggested that the opener was aboard Silver Wings of Morning. But not knowing precisely where to locate it, they could not risk damage befalling any of the ships in your bay.
He glanced at Cadence again, as if to reassure himself that the charred remains could not possibly be listening in.
Where is it, exactly?
That's the problem. I don't know.
Then we will have to look for it, and try to sabotage it, all of which must wait until we have survived Galingale's attack.
The nearest abeyance casket was only a short walk from the command deck. There were 4 units ranked against a wall, all of the same rounded rectangular white design, like squared-off eggs.
I don't like stasis. Nonetheless, stasis will protect you better than freezing. I will intervene to assist in your emergence back into real time, should difficulties ensue.
Hesperus opened the white doors of the nearest unit, revealing the white-on-white intricacy of the casket's interior. Stasis machinery, throne, control and containment systems, packed as tight as intestines. The chair pushed itself out, inviting me to lower my body into its doughy embrace. Controls nestled under my fingertips.
What ratio and time duration should I dial in? I'll deal with the settings. I don't want you emerging until we are certain that Galingale isn't going to pose a threat again.
Claustrophobia slipped its bony, cold fingers around my throat. What if I don't come out?
I'll be here to make sure you do. Do you have something to say to Campion before I put you under?
I settled into the throne, placing my hands and feet into the self-tightening restraining hoops.
Isn't it a bit late for that? You forget that I am a high-fidelity recording apparatus. Say what you will, and I will relay it to Campion as soon as communication becomes possible again.
Tell him that I love him, and I'm grateful that he came this far.
No, say it to me, as if I was Campion.
I took a breath. It felt unnatural to be looking into his golden face, trying to imagine my lover and friend standing there instead.
I love you, Shatterling.
Thank you for what you've done. Do whatever you can to stop Silverwings, but look after yourself as well. I want to see you again. I want to watch the sun go down with a good glass of wine and talk about all this as if it happened a long time ago, before we had many more adventures and good times.
You will, Hesperus said.
The seat retracted into the stasis cabinet, the restraints tightening to pin me in place. Hesperus closed the doors. I could still see him through a one-way window. A collar whirred into place around my neck and drew me deeper into the seat, firm enough to be uncomfortable but not enough to choke. A voice intoned a warning that I was about to go into stasis at a time compression ratio of 1,000,000, and that I should activate the emergency abort control immediately if I did not wish the field to snap around me.
Final warning, the voice repeated. Stasis will initiate in 3, 2, 1.
Hesperus vanished, blinking out of existence. The outside world flared blue and then settled slowly back to an illusion of normality. In the second it took me to think that I had been in the cabinet too long, 10 days had passed in the real time of my ship. Hesperus was either dead, or he had tricked me. My fingers moved over the tactile controls. I twisted the dial back down, feeling it click through the notches of ratio settings. 1,000,000, 100,000, 10,000. The voice said, "Please be advised that manual adjustment of the cabinet settings is no longer possible. Only external inputs are now recognized as valid."
Tens of seconds had passed. 100 days.
Silver Wings of Morning had already been traveling so close to the speed of light that her onboard time was flowing more than 20 times slower than planetary time.
She was still accelerating. 100 days of ship time was 2,000 days in the stationary universe. I could have held my breath since I had been put into the cabinet, but we had already crossed 6 years of space. Another 6 since I started thinking about the distance I had come. 12 years. More like 18 by now, or 20. In a very short while, Silver Wings of Morning would have put more than a century of flight time between itself and Nayume. In barely a day of cabinet time, we would arrive at the Stardam.
"Hesperus," I said, "you lying bastard.